absent. You're not awake. You are in the Senate Committee on Education and General Government. Welcome. Colleagues, I'll just tell you right now, so you can be happy about it, we have no committee on Thursday.
Yay.
School's out on Thursday.
We didn't run out of bills, did we?
Actually, we did. We only have a couple, and I'm not interested in moving those at this point in time. So we're going to wait until they pile up. The House has been kind of slow getting everything across the floor. So anyway, I'm sure you can put that 2 hours to use with good effort, or maybe even sleep in. Okay, well, we're going to start. First of all, there aren't very many folks here, but I'll remind everyone that you must turn off your cell phone, your PDAs, anything that beeps, because if I hear it, I'll ask you to make a contribution to Common School Fund. If you're here to testify, the sign-up sheet's over there. With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3104.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3104 provides that the governing body of a city with a population of more than 400,000 is the budget committee of that city's urban renewal agency.
Great. And the lovely Ms. Gravel has handed me a list with one person's name on it, Mark Rosenbaum.
What that bond would yield.
This is one hot little bill. Yeah. Well, maybe we'll just shut this hearing down. We don't need it.
I remember on my my license plate fee that I'm trying to get
through. I can be
here
at 8.
They can be here at 8.
Mr. Stent.
On a 10-year bond.
I wonder what would happen if you had a bill that was up and nobody was in the room.
Sorry, we were standing outside.
Thank you. Commissioner Stan, welcome.
My apologies.
Bought me on a 10-year bond. Bought me 2 years.
Okay. State your name for the record, even though I know who you are. Those in TV land don't.
I am Eric Stan from the Portland City Council, and good morning to everyone.
Good morning. Okay, what do you want this bill for?
I appreciate you taking the time for the hearing, and I appreciate being first on the agenda, and sorry for being outside there. This is a bill that would essentially put the Portland Development Commission's budget process in line with all of the urban renewal agencies across the state. The Portland Development Commission, which does terrific work and our council works hard to support, is an independent commission that has a budget of around, we'll say $200 million. Last year's $247 million of primarily property taxes. It performs the urban renewal functions that are necessary that most cities in the state have and does a terrific job. If you look at the River District, affordable housing, going back in history, most of the things you think about in Portland, the Portland Development Commission had a hand in. What our city council is seeking to do with this bill is give our city council an annual review of the Portland Development Commission budget. There's two ways that you do governing of agencies, as you know. One is the governing body and one is the budget committee. This bill would leave the Portland Development Commission as the governing body, so they would make all of the day-to-day, month-to-month decisions on who's the developer, what are the contracts, those types of things. And it would give our council the ability to become the budget committee and create essentially what I would call a check and balance. They would draft the budget, send it to us, we would review it, send it back to them, they would have the final adoption. If they made changes up to 10%, it would go in. If they changed more than 10%, it would come back to us. So it's essentially your check and balance system. At this point, we're the only city in the state that does not have the ability to put its development function into the regular budget process. I would also say, and for those of you who watch this closely, and I know many of you do, this isn't just about trying to get the Development Commission under control or any of the things you might hear from the other side. It's actually trying to make the system work better. I think this function, if it were to pass, would actually hold me more accountable. Because what you have now is you have a city council that is perceived to be in charge of a $247 million property tax budget, but in fact is not. It would be akin to, say, your transportation commission in Salem spending the money without appropriation from the legislature, but yet your constituents saying to you, what are you going to do about changing those priorities? So I think what you've seen is a system that was set up in the 50s, well-intentioned, I would say, but essentially so that the commission could function with the mayor's knowledge, but not with direct oversight. And I think, you know, to be honest, back in those days, the argument was we need to knock things down, we need to put in freeways, and we want the commission to do it independently. Here now we would like, and it's the unanimous request of our council coming from Mayor Potter and all four members, to be able to do this more transparently. We believe our budget process is better understood, better attended, better tied into planning efforts and others. And so this would essentially, I think, bring what's a good agency into a more accountable and transparent system and allow us to essentially do what I think we were elected to do, which is link up this kind of work. And I don't think you're going to find, if you search the state of Oregon, any other agencies run by a general tax such as property tax with no elected official direct oversight of the budget. I don't think you'll find one if you search, and this is certainly a large one. So I'll stop there. I think you probably are familiar with this, and be obviously glad to talk about any questions you might have, and I do appreciate your time.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I now see there's many more people in the room, so maybe other people want to sign up to testify. And I have a question for you, and then I see Senator Metzger has one. I received an email from someone named Jeff Miller, President and CEO of Portland, Oregon Visitors Association. He says, we are concerned with the timeline of this bill since there is a major concerning PDC's budget oversight on this month's election ballot. Can you explain that to me?
Absolutely. There are four charter change measures that the council has referred to the Portland ballot that our voters are voting on now. It's obviously a mail-in election. Votes will be counted next Tuesday. I won't share the other three unless you're interested. But one of them is an exactly parallel, identical measure to what's in front of you. And there's some ambiguity, you're familiar with these kind of situations, as if whether or not the PDC charter can be changed strictly by our voters or strictly by the legislature. So we decided to pursue both paths. The language in this did go through the House. It's permissive. Were the measure not to pass in Portland, we would not actually implement becoming the budget committee. It would allow us to do that if we chose, but we obviously, as you would not go against the will of our voters, which is widely expected if you look at the polling, the different sides of poll, then it's leading about 60-20 at this point. Polls don't always tell what's going to happen, so we'll see. But if, in fact, it does pass, you know, we certainly would, hope the legislature would help us in joining and making sure that our voters' wishes are essentially, you know, legally non-challengeable through what I would consider kind of a loophole to say, well, the state budget law isn't in line with this, so your voters' will doesn't count, essentially. So we basically started both of these. You have to start bills very early. We knew we were sending this to the ballot when we sent this down in January as a proposal to the legislature, and it actually is just kind of happenstance that it happens to have gone through the House and be on your committee's docket 7 days before the election. It could have been a couple weeks earlier. It could be next week. If you wanted to hold this measure until after the election, we certainly wouldn't have any objection to that as a premise. We'd still actually be down here arguing, say, our council ought to have this permissive authority. I mean, the idea that we're barred from state law from overseeing our own development commission's budget is, you know, bothersome to us. We would still want this, but wouldn't bother us.
Thank you. Let me ask you the second question, then I'm going to turn over to Senator Metzger, and then after we're done having you testify, I'm going to have to recess and go to another hearing for one of my colleagues from the House who needs to get to the floor. So we'll do that and come back to this. But the second point Mr. Miller raises in his letter contradicts what you were saying a moment ago, perhaps. So let me clear that up. He says House Bill 3104 would make Portland the only urban renewal district in the state where the city council alone has direct control over the agency's budget. Now, when you testified, you said this puts your budget process in line with all the other urban renewal agencies. So who's right and who's wrong here? Or is there some distinction with a difference?
I think we're both right, whether the distinction is a huge difference or not. This would put the Portland Development Commission into our budget process just like every other city does. They put it through their regular budget process. Almost but not all of the other cities in Portland utilize a budget committee, which is their council and appointed citizens. You tend to have more of a volunteer approach to the budget committee. Our budget committee is our council. So I hope this makes sense, every city that I know of, and I think it's all of them, I serve on the League of City Board, works their urban renewal through their budget committee. So what he's essentially arguing is you have a different budget committee than other cities. That whether that's the distinction that matters mm-hmm. or not. We actually have in the last, again, this is a Portland anomaly, we were not allowed to use citizens on our budget committee until last session when Representative Berger passed a bill that she sponsored that allowed us to do that. So we actually have recently added citizens to our budget process, and so we're closer to that other process. Our charter precedes a lot of the state budget law, so there's a lot of funny anomalies, and so the difference between the way our budget committee is adopted and the way other cities' budget committees are adopted is what he's getting at, I think.
Okay.
We actually, this actually is a step along with adding citizens to our budget process that is actually works in tandem to actually try and, I think, get us much more in line with all the other cities. So I hope that makes sense.
No, that does make sense. All right, thank you. Senator Metzger, you have a question?
Well, I think, Senator Walker, I think you asked my answered my question, and I think Commissioner Sten, I think, put the exclamation point on it. I would think that, well, just first of all, observation. Commissioner, I think you were talking about you'd like to have this permissive authority, but the way I read the bill, it's not permissive, it is directive.
Right.
You know, the governing body is the budget committee, so it isn't permissive, it does establish in statute. But I do believe that this is, and I understand the coincidence because it takes time to go through the process and you have to introduce legislation, you know, if you're going to, in January, to even have a hope of having this meeting in May. But I would say that I'm certainly happy to let the city of residents of Portland determine how they want to do this, and I know the Charter Review Commission wasn't supportive of this, but that debate is taking place in the city right now. This was not one of their recommendations, was it?
Well, I want to clarify that. The reason the Charter Review Commission did not take up the question of budget review, and that's being misplayed by opponents of this measure, and the reason they didn't take up this, it is this kind of funny knot we're in with state authority versus our voters, is they were told that if our voters passed the measure, which is all they were working on, is things that they could refer out to the voters, it may not count because it would take enabling state legislation to be sure it was valid. And they basically made a determination that they were only going to refer measures that didn't need anything else. And so they actually didn't decide yes or no on whether to refer this question, which is why it came to our council and we decided to send it down here as well as to the ballot. So they really didn't debate this at all. Most of them have said that they think this is in line with what they thought. Again, I would also say to the folks who are going to testify in opposition to the bill, because I asked the question of them this morning, who are all friends of mine and we work closely, well, if we were to say let's set this off till after the vote, would you agree to support this measure should our voters pass it? I mean that's the obvious compromise. So I would encourage you to ask that question.
Well, yeah.
Opponents as well.
That was going to be my point. You made that point. I think, Madam Chair, I think if the citizens of Portland decide they want to go this way, I have no problem bringing this bill back and making sure that they have statutory authority to do what their citizens want them to do. But mm-hmm. conversely, I wouldn't want to pass this today and have them decide they don't want it. So I think in one sense it's timely because we can have the discussion today, and if the city needs us to validate what the citizens want to do, I think we do that at that time.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. That's completely coincidental the way the calendars worked out. We introduced this in January as a proposal, and I mean, I actually would have bet it wouldn't have been to you till after the election, but I'm impressed that it's here.
All right. So. I think that might be a good way to go, but we do need to hear from those who signed up in opposition as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
I want to hear a little bit more about what that opposition is, because this seems a pretty reasonable approach to me.
Well, it's been a good debate. I think it's something that, you know, you have a good agency that's the charter that was passed in the 50s, and at times you want to update it. There is an argument, and I just want to be clear, because you're going to hear the two kind of mushed together, that the Development Commission should be an agency under the City Council, and there's a huge difference between Budget Committee and Governing Body. And where I think the line should be drawn, everybody agrees that the council should set the policies and PDC should implement them. I think budget, as you well know in this building, is at the heart of where policy is set. And you have to look at budgets to be able to set policy. Under the proposal we're making, we would work on a categorical budget. They would pick the projects, the developers, make the agreements. That's where I think if you were to put it just under our council, it would take away their authority, but I don't think budget does that. So the other piece too is that this budget has grown to $247 million in last year's budget.
That's a chunk of change.
To be blunt, it ends up being a staff-driven budget. You know how this works. I mean, we have terrific volunteer commissioners. I admire and respect each one of them, but we need the extra set of eyes on a budget of this size.
Okay. Commissioner, I appreciate your testimony very much.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and great to see all of you.
Okay, great. I'm going to close the public hearing temporarily on House Bill 3104. Open a public hearing on what bill?
House Bill 2950.
House Bill 2950. Representative Boone.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2950 requires the Port Commissioners to complete a one-day public management training course prior to taking the oath of office.
Okay, and if there's anyone out there to testify also on 30, Heather, excuse me, has testify on the last bill, this is your opportunity to sign up while we're hearing this bill.
Oh, Madam Chair, would you object to having the only other person who's...
No, then we can just punch this out and get it done.
And thank you for indulging my schedule. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2950. The Ports Group asked me to introduce this bill, and I was happy to do that. Oregon has 23 public port districts, and they are their officials, except for the Port of Coos Bay on Portland, are elected. And as we all know, elected positions are incurring more and more risk and liabilities, if you will. And so it seemed a good idea, prevention, and I'm all about prevention, to have them take a course of one day training in all the things that you should know: public records law, public budgeting, ethics, open meetings, and other elements of being an elected port commissioner. This bill is not trying to solve a problem, it's trying to prevent possible problems. There's no opposition that we know of. Special districts would support it. This isn't all special districts commissions being asked to do, it's just the ports. And right now there is... the main reason I would say is to help people who are becoming commissioners to, become more professional, as we're seeing a overturning of our whole port district in Astoria, the Port of Astoria, and actually nine candidates for three slots, which is pretty unusual. So you can see that these are becoming more and more sought after positions, and I think that it's a good idea. And the special districts can offer board-specific training under certain circumstances, and there's usually, when you get elected to these positions, it's usually in November, and there's about 3 months before you take office, and so it's plenty of time to complete the training. So with that, I will defer to my colleague here.
Okay, maybe Mr. Armstrong can tell me why no other elected official should be taking this training.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong representing the Oregon Ports Group. This bill essentially came out of discussions during the interim. Your colleague, Senator Betsy Johnson, and the Economic Development Commission, going through the Economic and Community Development Department statutory review process, we were talking about ports and some of the things the ports do, and Senator Johnson, as you know, as a former port commissioner, suggested maybe we ought to think about requiring port commissioners to go through some training to focus on public records, public budgeting, open meetings law, that sort of thing. Our response was, that's probably a pretty good idea. We've got a lot of folks out there, particularly in the very smaller rural areas of the state, that don't have as much experience with that. Sometimes running as a port commissioner is their first foray into elected office, and it would make some sense, perhaps, to undergo some sort of one-day training, which, by the way, Special Districts Association offers right now anyway for all of the elected officials that are part of special districts, water districts, sewer, vector control, et cetera, but that's optional. Our response to Senator Johnson was, yeah, let's go ahead and try going down this road, requiring port commissioners to have this sort of training. We certainly have no problem with the notion of expanding it beyond port commissioners. We thought maybe a smaller bite at the apple might make good sense to see how that unfolds and not open additional opposition if other associations of local governments might have problems with it. It's certainly sounding now like folks do not. Special Districts Association testified on the House side that it might make a great deal of sense to expand this to all of the districts that are under their membership, and that's certainly something we'd be interested in talking about. We thought moving forward in a smaller incremental approach made the most sense, but really it's, as Representative Boone said, an opportunity and an effort to increase the professionalism of the industry, and we're hoping that it yields that result. So with that, if there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to try and answer them.
Okay, I have two. They come to mind right away. Who's paying for the training?
Madam Chair, the training is going to be funded through Special Districts Association. They've got an annual conference, and then they also have smaller conferences around the state where they will provide, and we've had conversations with them in the crafting of this bill, they will provide that training free of charge to port commissioners. Now, if we want to go out into a specific port district, like let's say the Port of Hood River, those commissioners want to have training just for them because they can't get to a conference, Special Districts Association can come to that port and perhaps share the cost, but Special Districts has the means and the resources to help provide that, and it's pretty limited training. It, you know, it's about a 4 to 6 hour session, as I understand it.
Okay, second question, sort of a facetious one. Why is the Coos Bay Port and the Portland Port appointed and not elected?
Madam Chair, I can't answer that question. That has been ever thus, at least in my experience with the industry, that gubernatorial appointments for both Coos Bay and for Portland, and I'm not sure I can answer that.
Well, and this bill's a little bit narrow with a relating clause. Otherwise, I just might slap that in there. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Cruz and then Senator Westland.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed those who voted against the measure in the House, several of them represent ports. What's their objection?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I had a brief conversation with Greg Smith, and the representative basically said, you know, I can't be with you on this. It's a local control issue, and I'm going to have to vote no. And I said, that's perfectly fine. I understand that. His particular ports, as members of the Oregon Ports Group, support the bill. Has he had a conversation with an individual port commissioner who said, I'll be darned if I want to go and have training, and that led him to vote no? I don't know the answer to that. We didn't get into his opposition in detail, and it didn't seem to me that it was terribly intense opposition. He just felt it was more of a local control issue.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, there's some folks here I might want to have conversations with that are on the list. So
yeah, I'm not going to move the bill right at this moment, okay. So you'll have a little bit of time to
okay,
do
thank
that.
You.
Senator Westland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ken, I think that's a wonderful phrase, ever thus. I'm stealing that from you. Just comment on the bill. I think this is a very good bill, and it raises this spectrum that I think is a much broader issue. And in many of these special districts, and I would include the ports in that, I mean, the actual policies and procedures, the do's and don'ts, is a very big deal. And most of these are volunteer, these people serve, commitment to community in volunteer capacities, and they are, you know, constantly getting hauled before the Ethics Commission, because even when they act under the advice of counsel to recuse themselves or not, this is not a conflict for you, even under the advice of counsel, they act under that advice, you know, don't declare a conflict, do declare a conflict, whatever it is. Next thing you know, these volunteers that are really the backbone of our communities in these road and sewer and fire districts are getting hauled before the Ethics Commission. So I think, you know, which any citizen has a right and, you know, to bring a complaint. So it's not that they shouldn't be brought when there are ethical issues. They certainly should. But many of these, I think a little training would go a long way. It's just a question of knowledge and understanding, not a question of trying to circumvent the law or break one of the bylaws of that particular district. So I think this is a very good bill. It is narrow in scope. I agree with Mr. Armstrong's comments with regard to, almost a pilot type approach. When and if this comes back, Madam Chair, I'd be very much in support of this bill.
Just, Madam Chair, an additional comment. Mm-hmm. I mean, because Port of Brookings has had a few issues, one might say. But I think an overriding issue here and something long-term needs to be looked at is the fact that Curry County has three port districts. The question is, do they need three? I mean, there's some other issues here. I mean, we have 23. Some of them are very, very small, and we're looking at accountability and all of the functions that a port commission should have. Mm-hmm. And maybe we need to be putting some thought into some centralization, because it is becoming a more complicated world, obviously. And just throw that out for fodder, because, when you look, I mean, Brookings is hot right now, obviously, but when you look at the issues that are happening there and in Astoria, and you go to other ports, the desire to put yourself in the middle of that mix may become problematic over time. So I think big picture, we need to be looking at that, maybe making some adjustments.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, your comment is timely. One of the discussions we've had with Senator Johnson over the last several weeks has been the need to take an interim look at the ports as an industry, that being one of the central issues, at least on her short list. Clearly, on that, you really do run smack into the notion of local control and, does the community of Garibaldi feel like it ought to be governed by, folks from Tillamook or what have you, because that's another county that has right. The same situation as Curry. Right. And so you run into some of those very problems, but those are some of the things that we are talking about very aggressively getting into. As soon as signee die, I would say we're going to start digging into some of those issues through Senator Johnson.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Question, Senator Morris.
This is a rhetorical question, Madam Chair. How much training do legislators get?
Not enough. I mean, over here in the Senate, we certainly are supposed to figure it out by now, unless you're a freshman, which doesn't happen very often. But you're right. Sometimes they do trainings before. I remember in the House, we had extensive trainings, which was really helpful. But
sort of.
All right. Well, I just need to chew on this just a teensy bit.
Yeah.
And Senator Cruz needs to get some questions answered. We'll probably see you back here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks
for switching the schedule a little bit to help.
You're welcome. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2950. Reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3104. Getting the list again so we can start all over. Got a couple of people. Okay. Let's see. The rest of the people want to justify in opposition, so we'll just bring them all three at once. Mark Rosenbaum, Bernie Bottomley, and Jack Gusselman. There's two out of the three. Jack? Okay, we don't need to wait. You can start.
Madam Chairman, my name is Mark Rosenbaum. Pleasure to join you this morning. I'm the chairman of the Portland Development Commission. Good morning, senators. I'm here to testify in opposition to the proposed legislation and provide some background. I think the last time I was in front of a Senate was when I was vice chair of the Oregon Welfare Review Commission, which was probably 15 years ago. And my volunteer services generally focused around children and the family issues. I was chair of Multnomah County's Commission on Children and Families, so working on economic development is a nice blending of the two. A little history, which I'm sure you're all aware of, is that the Portland Development Commission was set up by charter to have an independent, to be an independent, quasi-independent governing body 50 years ago. There was quite a debate at that time about whether City Council should be the urban renewal area agency for the city or not. And after extensive discussion, it was decided that it was best to have some kind of a veiled wall between the two bodies to create some distance between the potential for short-term politically based decision-making and rewards and longer-term economic development. It's worked quite successfully over the last 50 years, and I was surprised when I found this legislation moving so quickly. I was very appreciative of Senator Mesker's comments and, Madam Chair, your comments about respect for the ongoing ballot process in Portland. There is a matter in front of the voters asking this exact question. Should City Council become the budget committee for the Portland Development Commission? So I'm glad that the sentiment seems to be that the committee may wait for that vote before changing state law, because it would make, in essence, the vote of the people worthless. And that is something we'd want to avoid at all costs. I think the second thing that is quite remarkable about the proposed legislation is that it would make the budget committee of the Portland Development Commission the only budget committee in the state where there wouldn't be one single member of the governing body as a member. So in essence, you have an attempt to create closer partnership between the Development Commission as a quasi-independent body and the City Council. But in so doing, the way you set it up is almost adversarial. Instead of setting up a partnership where you have members of the Development Commission and City Council jointly on the Budget Committee, so those of us who are charged with the operation and the establishment of policy for the Development Commission to be a part of the originating Budget Committee, it was set up in this legislation so that City Council alone would be the budget committee for the Development Commission. I find that too adversarial in nature. You've heard some comment about the fact that this would be that Portland is the only development agency in the state where the City Council is not the budget committee and governing body for the Urban Renewal Agency. To me, the most appropriate question isn't what is happening in the rest of the state of Oregon, but equally important is what's happening in comparably sized cities around the United States in terms of their development agencies and the most effective ones. And if you look at the City of Portland's Services and Accomplishments Report, which is an evaluation of our Bureau's operation annually inside the city, you'll see we compare ourselves to numerous cities around the state, including around the country, including cities such as Sacramento and Seattle and other cities of similar size. And if you look at the development agencies those cities handle, over 50% of them are independent or quasi-independent in nature. So I think that's very important. That isn't what is happening in the rest of the state, but rather in the city, in the state's largest city, what should our models be? You should know that there is no unanimity in terms of support for this change from the city, in that former mayors Vera Katz, former mayor Bud Clark, the Oregonian, the Portland Tribune, former city commissioners Mike Lindbergh and Margaret Strawn, and the chair of the Citizens Review Commission that studied this matter for 19 months, have all urged a no vote on the ballot measure in the city of Portland. The City Club of Portland issued a 10-page analysis of making the City Council a budget committee for this agency and urged a no vote in the strongest possible terms, and also explicitly said that the ballot title used to send this to the voters in Portland was, quote, deliberately deceptive. Remarkably deceptive was their word, remarkably deceptive. So I have great heartburn as well about whether the citizens of Portland really understand what it is they're being asked to vote on, because the ballot title in no way identifies the fact that this is a major move and change in the balance of power and in the checks and balances which have worked so effectively over the last 50 years. So urge some caution in analyzing this. I know this is a local matter, and the Senate would move cautiously in any event, but felt obligated to say this commission has, over the last year and a half, changed dramatic policy on behalf of the City Council, and in working closely with them, issues like minority hiring, issues like prevailing wage law, rates, which is now being used as the model for the House and the Senate for changing your action in regard to labor rates, and minority contracting. And that's all been hand-in-hand with City Council. We want to be partners, but I'm not certain that handing the balance this much over to City Council doesn't change things dramatically and not necessarily for the better.
Okay, let's hear from everyone, and then we'll have some questions. Mr. Bottomley?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Bernie Bottomley with the Portland Business Alliance. We're an organization of 1,300 small, medium, and large businesses in the greater Portland metropolitan area. I'm appearing in opposition to the language in 3104. I want to echo the comments of Mr. Rosenbaum. I think we share all of his concerns. I think historically PDC has worked very well precisely because of its quasi-independent status. It can make good investment decisions which create increment, which in turn can be used to address issues in the city, such as the need for low-income housing and other services. If you don't create increment and if you don't have the independence to make good financial decisions as opposed to responding to the political dynamics of the moment, you don't create that increment and you don't have the resources to address the issues that are so important to ensuring that a vital and growing downtown Portland and neighborhoods are available. Mr. Rosenbaum mentioned the City Club of Portland report, and I'll just I have a copy of that here with me, and I'd just like to point out their comment on this, that in their interviews with the Charter Review Commission, they came to the conclusion that the Commission did not recommend this change. This was added by City Council after the Charter Review Commission's recommendations were forwarded to City Council. And they feel very strongly that PDC's separation from City Hall allows it to make good judgment based on financial merits of proposals rather than the political calculus of the moment. And City Club adopted their resolution 86-0. I'd also like to leave you a copy of a editorial from the Portland Oregonian, which says, "Don't rob the PDC, giving the Portland City Council budget authority over the agency would cripple it." I think there's a model that was used this year that strikes a balance, and that's really what's needed here, is a balance between the City Council setting policy and PDC having the flexibility and the input into the budget process to make sure that it can fulfill the policy that the City Council has established for it. This language, because it's prescriptive, we don't think would strike the appropriate balance. We believe that there are alternatives to this language that would allow and set up a framework that would have both input from the PDC and input from the City Council.
And what is that language, Mr. Bottomley?
We can provide that to you. We've been talking with City Council about whether we could get agreement at City Council, and essentially it's a process that was used this year. Two members of City Council, two members of the PDC Commission, and a fifth member appointed at large. It was a very successful process each year. Make sure that both entities have significant input into the process and that neither one has undue influence over the final budget product. I just want to address one other thing that Commissioner Sten mentioned and I think is of concern to us. The current process has tremendous public input. Each of the urban renewal areas has a governing or an advisory body that has input into the process as they go through developing the budget. PDC does a tremendous job of working with citizen committees. Portland Business Alliance has a budget review committee for PDC that is very active. We spend about 4 months every year going line by line through the budget and advising the city and PDC about where we think the priorities should be. We think that the current process provides a tremendous bottom-up opportunity for folks, for the public to be involved. And at least in our experience, it's the most inclusive budget development process in the city. No other bureau of the city has the kind of public input into the development of their budget that PDC does. And our concern is that if the budget development process is exclusively with City Council, that we will lose that opportunity not only to focus on what those projects that can make sense from a financial standpoint, but those projects that are widely supported by the public and have their input. So, thank you.
Okay.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman of Tonkin Torp, appearing on behalf of the Software Association of Oregon today. I would just echo the comments of Mr. Rosenbaum and Mr. Bottomley. The Software Association of Oregon is interested in this bill primarily because we are, as I've testified before, you members of this committee and other committees, we're the state's largest locally headquartered technology trade association. We have 600 members statewide. A number of those members are in the Portland metropolitan area, and in fact, our office is located, our headquarter office is located a few blocks from PDC. While we have many members, we don't have a lot of staff, and we rely heavily on technical assistance from both the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, local economic development agencies, and urban renewal agencies like the PDC. And our concern with this bill would be the degree to which there it could invite resource dilution at PDC that would hamper the partnerships that we build with them. Our members do not directly benefit from tax increment. We benefit from the economic development expertise and the outreach efforts that we're able to partner with PDC on. And that would be the nature of our concern with the bill. So we would seek from this committee an opportunity to support PDC and efforts to work with the City Council to try to find a more acceptable resolution to the Portland Development Commission to this situation.
Okay, now you get my questions. I had my staff bring down my City of Portland notebook because I remember there were some things going on with the Portland Development Commission in 2005 that raised significant concerns in my mind as well as residents of the City of Portland. So let me start. Mr. Bottomley, you said that there is a good budget process and lots of citizens involved, but I'm reading an article here from the Oregonian in 2005, Potter pushes PDC to take on a new project itself. And right here it says, the City Club of Portland, a civic affairs group, knocked the commission for not involving citizens enough in its decisions. Don Mazziotti, for my colleagues' edification, was the executive director, the former executive director. Mazziotti's relationship with the board soured this year, and he resigned in June. There was also a very big public mix-up, foul-up, concern about a major redevelopment project at the east end of the Burnside Bridge. And as Commissioner Sten noted, the budget is pretty huge. So while you may think you have citizen input, who's watching the money? And there was also some ethics violations brought against Mr. Mazziotti for misuse of funds. So I'd like some conversation about that.
Well, I'm not going to speak specifically to Mr. Mazziotti, but I think the City Council, 2 points on that. One is, Mr. Mazziotti is gone. I think the PDC has done a tremendous job of adopting a number of the recommendations that the City Club of Portland made regarding how it could do a better job of responding to public input. The bottom line is, what is the appropriate balance between City Council input and PDC input? The City Council currently has the authority to approve PDC commissioners, their annual general fund allocation to PDC, which is small, but it is an important piece of leverage that they have. They approve urban renewal plans and changes in urban renewal districts, and any bonds that are sold. So City Council has extensive authority to influence PDC. I don't think there's a realistic case that can be made that PDC is some sort of rogue agency that goes off and does its own thing. City Council has very extensive and detailed authority over the agency. The Alliance supports the City Council having the authority to direct PDC, and we think it's an appropriate role for the City Council to direct PDC and develop its overall goals. The concern that we have is where the City Council is drafting the budget essentially from the ground up and making all of the decisions about what PDC will do on specific projects, specific locations, and we think that strikes the balance too far in the direction of City Council.
Okay. Mr. Rosenbaum, do you want to respond?
Sure. Question you ultimately pose is who's watching the money?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Portland Development Commission is subject to an annual audit. That annual audit has received the highest standards, the annual prize, the Blue Ribbon for Government and Accounting Standards across the country for the last 19 years. Aside from that, the city auditor does substantial performance audits of what PDC does. This year, Madam Chairman, Commissioner Wilhoit and myself participated with City Council in 15 separate meetings reviewing PDC's budget. In a $225 million budget, there was less than $500,000 of suggested changes. So to assert that the PDC is radically out of step with the policies and strategies that the City Council has in mind, I don't think can be supported. Clearly, there were some issues that were going on a couple of years ago that needed repair, and I think if you look at this year's City Club report, they specifically state that PDC has made remarkable changes in terms of its internal operation, and they reassert their finding that PDC must remain as a quasi-independent agency in order to be effective, even though they had the concerns in 05. This year's report reasserts that position.
Do any of you have the report? Mr. Bottomley, you do? Can you provide
I have copies as well, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? We have some more email that has come in that I'll have Ms. Richardson distribute to all of you. I'm not sure you're all getting it. Looks like you got some of it here. This email is from Linda Nedikoven, did I pronounce that correctly, from the City Club Study Committee member. She represents the members of the City Club of Portland who adopted a position to oppose efforts to make Portland City Council the Budget Committee. We believe strongly this change would give Portland City Council too much control over decisions now made by PDC and would effectively end the agency's quasi-independent status. So it sounds to me like you've got a variety of opinions on this issue and you're taking a vote on May 15th. So my inclination is to let the residents of the City of Portland decide what they want to do for themselves. If they like that idea, then we'll come back and we'll give them the enabling legislation to do it. If you have some other change you want to make to this, I suggest you have conversations with the City of Portland and you all come back. But at this point, I'm prepared to move the bill if the Portland folks vote to approve the ballot measure.
I'm sure.
Senator Cruz.
It was brought up in testimony that there may be issues with ballot titles. We know that ballot titles can be contentious. I would like to have a copy of that ballot title,
yes,
as I do not vote in the City of Portland.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, it's in
the... Is this in here? Okay.
Just getting it just now. Amends charter defines mission increases oversight of Portland Development Commission. That's pretty straightforward. Maybe a lawyer could nuance that. But
Madam Chairman, the mm-hmm. point of concern of the City Club and of those of us watching this was that in the ballot title there is no indication that it isn't just a change in oversight, but it is actually a shift of authority. You're not overseeing someone else's process. In fact, what they're doing is becoming the originating body of the budget. That is a dramatic shift, and that was, I think, the concern of the City Club. Remains my concern that when this vote is taken, we anticipate maybe 50,000 out of 400,000 registered voters will participate in the election upcoming. And so a second concern is, given the deceptive nature of the ballot title, whether 30,000 voters in Portland are indeed an indication of a mandate for a change such as this. I think it's something we can discuss after the vote is taken, but it is of concern to me.
Well, you could say that, Mr. Rosenbaum, about any single election we take in this state. And if we ever were to just tell the voters we don't care what you think because only 30,000 of you voted, we'd be in a hell of a lot of trouble. Excuse my French. That argument doesn't go anywhere with me. Why do the French always get blamed for swearing? I just realized that.
I'm sure that's more of a technical term than a French term.
I think so. Let me ask you this final question, and then I'll ask my committee if they have any. If you're so concerned about the ballot title, why didn't you challenge it before it went on the ballot? Don't you have that process and that ability?
It's really interesting. Being new to this process of ballot measures, it did not occur to me that we could challenge the title until 7 days after it was created, which, of course, was too late to respond. You only have 6 or 7 days to challenge a ballot title. And I think count it up as a chalk it up to a learning process on the part of the chairman and some others.
Okay, I don't have a comment to that. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Gentlemen, thank you for coming today. I appreciate it. I see no other person signed up to testify. As I said, we'll hold this bill in abeyance until the election, and then we'll bring it back if we need to. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3104. Okay, what's next?
House Bill 2090.
We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2090. Ms. Richardson, what is this bill about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2090A permits the Secretary of State to refuse to file documents containing unredacted Social Security numbers, state identification numbers, driver's license numbers, credit or debit card numbers, or account numbers. It deletes the requirement that certain documents filed with the Secretary contain those Social Security numbers, federal employer identification numbers, and taxpayer identification numbers. It charges the Secretary with developing a system to provide unique identifiers for the Farm Products Central Filing System, declares an emergency, and take effect upon passage.
Okay. We've got a representative of the Secretary of State's office, the only person to sign up. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Peter Threlkeld. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office, and it's my pleasure to be here to talk to you today about House Bill 2090. This is a bill that we came up with in the last year, really to look at and address growing problems that we have seen in the area of identity theft. Identity theft has become a growing concern in this state and nationally. And most of the past actions taken to prevent identity theft have been, for people to protect their incoming and outgoing mail, to shred documents that have personal information, and for those that hold that information to provide better security for their laptops and their databases so that these numbers are not vulnerable. One area that really has been overlooked so far is that there are a lot of a lot of this information does exist in public record. And in Oregon, the public record law, ORS 192, requires that all public records are available to be disclosed to any person upon request. And so we really see this as a vulnerability. In the past, we've our statutes that we administer have required certain information like federal ID numbers, and in the absence of having a federal ID number by the IRS will tell you to use your Social Security number, so there's a bit of a crossover there, and again, more vulnerability. And so what we wanted to do with the bill, and I'll just try and summarize for you, we wanted to prevent
sensitive personal information from being introduced into public record in the first place. We want to eliminate the existing statutory requirements for that information to be reported. And we think that these are good steps, good measures to help protect businesses and individuals in Oregon from identity theft. I think with that, really around the concept of, as individuals, it's your information, and you should be in charge of when you release it and who you release it to. When it comes into a public record, that really goes out the window, because we in government are prevented from being able to help control that. It's now public record and has to be disclosed. So what the bill doesn't do, it doesn't prevent you when you go for a loan from providing your information to the lender. And so, you know, we believe that businesses and individuals will still have ample access to credit. We've actually not entered any of this information in our databases for 7 to 8 years. Any information that we have had in the databases has been purged out. So we believe that we're pretty clean there. It's just it exists in some public record documents, in the paper filings that have been microfilmed or imaged and are available for someone to come and request. The other thing that the bill does is it makes technical fixes to the Central Farm Products filing system as requested by the Oregon Bankers Association to make that program work a little bit better for the lenders and the buyers of farm products. We also, in that same system, adopt new federal provisions to allow the creation of a unique identifier as opposed to being required to use a social security number of a debtor or a rancher or farmer that might have borrowed money on cattle or crops that they intend to sell. So that's kind of the summary of what we look to do. We believe it's a good bill. We would ask for your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you. Senator Cruz has a question.
I got a couple. Just a curiosity, because you're referencing 21 ORS chapters. How broad is that scope? Is that basically all documents under the purview of the Secretary of State, or...
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, yes, we actually, in the Corporation Division, each of the different filing programs are set up in a separate chapter. So we administer a number of chapters, and so we were looking to get a good, broad, comprehensive cleanup there. And it's information that we don't use. It came into play probably 20, 25 years ago, and I think the original intent was to allow better indexing of the businesses, and what we found over the years is that the information was often inaccurate. It was very spotty to come in. A lot of businesses just refused to provide it, and so we were faced early on with, you know, do we slow down the process of business for this information that really didn't serve much value to us in administering the programs of our agency?
Thank you. Well, and clearly, if some of these documents you really don't need anyway, I suppose that's fine. But another question would be, why would you be redacting the entire document rather than just the information that you don't want in public record?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, we would just redact that piece of information. So just the Social Security number, just that sensitive piece of information.
So you still file the document, you just redact...
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. We currently ask filers when we can, if we see the information there, we alert them that what's happening is that this is available for anyone in the world to request, and do they really want to put it in there? A lot of times, documents are filed by a third party. It's not filed by the person. None of you would probably come to us and say, here's my Social Security number, put it on the public record. But you may borrow money to buy a boat and a boat motor, and when you do that, that lender often because they can't title that vehicle and take a security interest through DMV, they'll file a document with our office to secure their interest, and unfortunately, a lot of times, it winds up, your numbers wind up in the document, and then people are put at risk.
Okay.
I know, I think of my own situation. I'm self-employed, and I'm also a member of a partnership. My self-employed federal ID number is my Social Security number, and the partnership has a taxpayer identification number with federal government. So on some documents, I have to give my Social Security number, and on others, I give the federal ID number. And I sure hate giving up my Social Security number, not knowing who's going to see it. In fact, I used to put it on my invoices as my taxpayer ID number. That was really stupid. That was years ago, before we all got hinky about ID theft and thinking about what happens there. So I think we've got ourselves a good little bill. Anybody okay. have a question, Senator Metzger?
I just have one question. On vintage documents where you would have on your file some of this information from the past, do you have have you established any policies on that so that if some whoever comes and requests those types of information documents and those who are then providing them notice that it has some of this information because they're old documents, are they instructed to remove that before they provide it, or what's the policy on that for those types of things?
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, we've had an existing internal policy in the division for at least the last 5 years that our staff, before they release those documents, they take a review through them, and they redact that information before they release it. It's, you know, I think if we were sued, the AG would probably say we didn't have the authority to do that. So, you know, that's a...
Now you will.
Between this bill and Senate Bill 583, we will.
Okay.
So...
583?
Is the Senator Przanski's identity theft bill.
Okay.
Yeah, because I don't think there's anything in this bill that requires you to redact. It just means renew filings. But so you're saying the other bill does that, gives you the authority to go back?
The other bill takes care of existing documents. Okay. This one is really focused on new documents coming in.
Okay. So we definitely need 583. Did we vote on that already?
No.
Well,
I don't think it's been on
the
floor yet.
Why hasn't it been to the floor?
I asked that question of the president today, and I said, how many more Senate bills do we have in the pipeline, and who's going to get an answer?
Seems like eons ago. Okay. Good question, Senator Metzger. Any other questions? Okay, Mr. Carfel, I think we're happy with this bill. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2090, open a work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2090A engrossed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2090A engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Ms. Gravel, you're on.
Senator
Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Westphal?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
House Bill 2090A is off to the Senate, and who would like to carry that?
I'll carry that, Madam Chair.
Okay.
You can't do that. He didn't vote against it.
Could we recall the roll?
I can't believe you'd vote for a Secretary of State bill.
Well, in spite of Elon Hassan.
Yeah. Okay. So it looks to me like we are at 2264. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2264.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2264A exempts the Department of Education from provisions of the Department of Administration Procurement Code when procuring goods, services, and information technology related to student assessment, declares an emergency, and would take effect upon passage.
Okay. Morgan Allen and Nolan Campbell. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and we're here today to ask for your support for House Bill 2264A engrossed version, which we drafted with help and input from the Department of Administrative Services. And I want to state very clearly and unequivocally, if you're looking through your bill folder and looking at the original version of the bill, it was drafted much broader than we intended. The original version of the bill exempted the superintendent, the State Board of Education, and the entire Department of Education from the entirety of the public contracting code, which was not our intention. We are seeking a narrow exemption from the Department of Administrative Services procurement authority, not the public contracting code. So I want to make that very clear on the record, because we had a lot of questions about that in the House. And 2264, as was explained, relates to student assessments and that the procurement of student assessments, and quite simply, that's the basket of goods and services that we purchase relating to how students are tested and assessed. And those things can include paper and online testing assessments, publishing and printing of test forms, technical assessment manuals, and several other things you'll see in the written testimony. So 2264 permits the Department of Education to procure or supervise the procurement of goods, services, personal services, and information technology strictly related to those types of student assessments. And I'm going to actually read this from the testimony because I want to make this very clear. All procurements conducted under the authority in this bill will still be subject to the Public Contracting Code, the Oregon State Procurement Code, and also subject to the Legal Sufficiency Review Program of the Attorney General's Office. And so you may be asking why we're here today asking for this exemption to the DAS procurement authority. And the short answer is we need flexibility with things like No Child Left Behind when the federal government gives us new testing mandates. Frankly, sometimes the DAS procurement code is somewhat inflexible and time-consuming and doesn't allow us to sort of make changes on the fly when the federal government or the state give us new mandates for testing. And there is plenty of statutory precedent for this. Many, many other agencies, and I listed just a few on the second page, including the Department of Fish and Wildlife, DHS, State Parks, the Department of Aviation, Corrections, Attorney General, and many others have. When you look at the bill, you see very specific, carved-out, narrow procurement authorities that they have. We believe that this bill will not impact, it doesn't have a fiscal impact for the department. We have an in-house procurement staff that works with DAS already. Our top five senior procurement staffers have over 70 years of combined experience dealing with contracts and procurements. And again, you'll see also, I handed out a letter from the Department of Administrative Services Chief Procurement Officer Diane Lancaster. They helped us develop the amendments that became part of the Ian Gross version of the bill. They're neutral on the bill, and they offer a good explanation as well, too, in their one-pager. This bill passed 56-1 in the House, and we respectfully ask that you send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. And I've brought with me Nolan Campbell, who's our Director of Procurement Services for the Department of Education, to help answer questions, and also we vie for who has the shortest haircut at the department. So we're in competition, and he's letting his hair grow out right now. So,
all right. Well, we have someone at my husband's work who agreed to get his beard and his mustache saved off for charity, and they raised over $500 for that purpose. So maybe I'll suggest they go to the head next too.
Money making opportunity for
Mr. Campbell, did you have anything to add?
Madam Walker, for the record, my name is Nolan Campbell, and I'm Director of Procurement Services for the Department. Really just here to answer any questions if they may come.
Okay. Senator Metzger.
I just have one question. Is this bill in any way, the desire for this authority emanate from your assessment provider that kind of pulled the rug out under the department a number of months ago?
Yes. Chair Walker and Senator Metzger, that's a very good question. It was asked on the House side as well by Representative Dahlem and several other committee members when we were over there. This, as you'll see, this bill was actually pre-session filed well in advance of our incident with our testing contractor for the online test system with Vantage. And this, actually, the idea of this dates back to work that Nolan had done dating back to, I think, 2005, where we worked with some other states and looked at the way departments do contracting for procurement assessments. And there was a study group in 2005, and I can let him talk a little bit more specifically about that, that recommended these types of changes. So it is a separate and unrelated issue, and we hope the committee looks at that. You know, the situation with Tessa and Vantage was unfortunate. The largest contract that would be applicable under this bill, which is the TESA contract, has already been signed for the next 5 years with American Institutes for Research. So that contract has been signed, so that this bill would not impact the new contract for the new TESA online contractor that will be up this fall. So hopefully the committee can treat those as separate issues. This bill was thought out before this all happened. So.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much money are we talking about?
So, Chair Walker, Senator Morris, the total, we have the TESA contract totals at about $2.4 million annually, and there's another major contract that would be done under this, which totals at about half that, at about $1.2 million annually. And then there are several other smaller activities. Actually, there's a multitude of other smaller activities that also end up totaling at about $1 million. So the total would be then... about 4.6.
4.6. And explain again, if I may, Madam Chair, why current contracting law is an impediment.
Okay. Chair Walker, Senator Morse, the current code, as it's drafted, at $150,000 in a procurement activity, require the procurement to be handled by the Department of Administrative Services State Procurement Office, and then they have complete contract authority to release the proposal, to manage the contract, and they oversee the entire process. And what happens in that situation, we found, is that you end up with an additional layer of communication between yourself and the vendor, which for some kinds of procurement, that's helpful. An example would be commodities like office supplies. That's an area where DAS is of great help because they have an expertise in that function, whereas we have an expertise in the area of assessment. And so there's a lot of effort given to explaining the processes for assessments and what it means, and we have to kind of educate the buyer in that situation, whereas the buyers here at the department are very versed in some of those procurement activities that are related to assessment, and so it's a more direct communication. It's really just a streamlining effect, I think, if you wanted to summarize what it would do.
Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
Does this bill in any way change the competitive bidding requirements?
Absolutely not. Going to ensure that we have a model and a method that goes exactly the same as the others do. We don't want to confuse the vendor community, and so we're going to follow the exact same procurement code as we do for all contracts.
And this bill just deals with assessments, so you still have to go through DAS for all your other procurement.
That's issues. Correct. The carve-out specifically identifies the Oregon revised statutes that identify the areas of assessment that we're discussing.
Okay. Any other questions? Committee satisfied with the answers? Okay. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Close public hearing on House Bill 2264A. Open a work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2264A engrossed to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2264A engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Not. Ms. Gravel?
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Westphal?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. House Bill 2264A is approved. We'll go to the floor. Senator Morse, do you want to carry that? You're our finance guy. Okay. And I got all mixed up because we got one out of order. Where am I at?
3466.
Okay. I love it that you know what's going on. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3466. Oh, this is an interesting one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3466 appoints the Department of Agriculture to deliver and prepare information for Soil and Water Conservation District Board elections. It allows people to file, document, and receive write-in votes for Soil and Water Conservation District Director positions if there's no nominee that for the position that qualifies to have their name placed on the ballot. Requires the write-in candidate to request a tally of write-in votes for them at least 25 days before the date of election. Prohibits the tallying of write-in votes for Soil and Water Conservation District Director elections when no qualified nominee appears on the ballot and no write-in candidate requests that write-in votes be tallied. It authorizes the Soil and Water Conservation District Governing Board to fill the position by appointment if no nominee qualifies for election or a request tally of write-in votes. Provides for declaring a director positions vacant and for filling vacancies prior to scheduled term expiration. We have two sets of amendments before us. I don't think either of them are entirely pleasing, but I'm going to suggest that I describe the dash twos for your discussion. The dash two amendment specifies that persons filing the request to tally write-in votes must file declaration with the Department of Agriculture at least 14 days before the date of election rather than 25 in the bill. Directs the department to determine whether the person requesting tally of the write-in votes meets the qualifications to become a district director. Requires the department to notify the county clerk to count the write-in votes for a qualified requester. It prohibits the county clerk from tallying write-in votes unless such notification is received. It specifies that if there is no nominee or qualified write-in candidate, a person shall be appointed to the unfilled position.
Well, this is really interesting because, and I see we have someone from the East Lane Soil and Water Conservation District. We had no one signed up for that position in an election a couple of years back, and I know my son wrote himself in and got several people to write in his name and, because he thought that would be pretty cool. And I don't know how many votes he ever got because they never told us. So I'm anxious to hear about this bill. So let's hear from John McDonald, Jan Coleman, and Paul Reed. And we don't have room for the fourth person unless you can pull up a chair for the Department of Agriculture.
Madam Chair, I just, for the record, I was on the Soil and Water Conservation District Board for 20-plus years and was president of the State Association, so I know these folks.
Oh, good.
That's probably why people aren't signing up to run.
Yeah.
Yeah, if we can pull up another chair, we can get you all up at once. That must be where you learned how to be so smart in the legislative process.
Well, actually, Madam Chair, I was on Governor Kitzhaber's group that created the Oregon Salmon Recovery Plan, and which was the reason I ran for legislature.
The Oregon Plan.
There you go. All right.
Did we just long,
way back then, right, John?
Okay. Well, who would like to start this discussion? Maybe Mr. McDonald, since you're with the Association of Conservation Districts.
And Chair Walker and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity for all four of us to see if we can't add a little bit of clarity to the possibly unorthodox manner of bringing these things matters before you. As president of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, I represent those 291 director positions and the 45 districts in looking at a series of things that we're trying to do through this bill. Some of them are to clarify some confusions that are in our original 568 statute, sort of looking at some things that have happened since it was drafted that we needed to kind of address because things we didn't anticipate back in 1940 have kind of hit us here. So, but I want to give you a little bit of background as to how it has traveled through the legislature since it was first introduced. On April 6th, we testified at a public hearing before the House Elections Ethics and Rules Committee. At that time, we introduced an amendment because we noticed that one of the provisions about the sending in of the declaration of intent didn't have a send it to where. So we said maybe you should insert, you know, send it to the department. And then in discussions with the elections committee and election clerks and so forth, we determined that 25 days might be a little bit restrictive and that all of us were willing to live with 14 days as the final delivery of that declaration prior to election day. Those were the two things that we requested. For reasons unknown to us, we've received comments from the committee administrator and others and so forth that it just didn't get done, and they apologized that it kind of got dropped somewhere. When it was passed in the committee on, I believe, the 20th, and then went to the floor where it was, you know, 48 A's and no nays, we were told that we should bring it to the Senate. and get the committee here to do the amendment process.
I appreciate that. You know, we try to make sure our bills are all fixed and ready to go before we lob them over to the House.
We were, Chair Walker, of that intent as well, but it for some reason didn't quite occur. And I think Mr. Stembridge, the committee administrator, probably had a couple conversations with Dana Richardson about how that arrived here, unfortunately, for you to fix.
So. Well, thank you. Just what we need, another work group. But yeah. Anyway, continue.
Okay. We have actually drafted, Senator Walker, the language that we hoped would finally come out. We're not particularly pleased with what was at one point -1 and -2 now, because it isn't quite clear enough about one of the major tenets that we hope will be in the legislation that could have been corrected by the original intent to do something relatively simple. Before we get into that, which all the other members I'm sure will address, I did want to indicate that there's a series of housekeeping things we're trying to do with this bill. Of course, one of the issues is there has been a question as to the authority of the Department of Agriculture to be the elections officer for conservation mm-hmm. districts. They've been doing it for many years. But some people called the secretary's office and said, is this really true? Are the county elections people supposed to be taking care of this? Or is the Department of Agriculture supposed to be taking care of this and so forth? So just one of the provisions in here just nailed it down saying, yes, it is the Department of Agriculture's responsibility to be the elections officer. So there's no more question regarding that. The no candidate file we'll talk about in considerable detail. One of the issues that Dean Richardson mentioned was that we are also having some issues about vacancies. When does a vacancy occur? And we've had the assumption in the statute that, your term ends when a new successor is appointed or elected. Well, we've had people sit out there and there was no successor elected, and so, does that mean they stay in office? Do they keep going until whatever happens? So we've just set some clarifications that this is when your term ends, and clarify some other reasons as to why a person's term might be declared vacant in addition to the ones that were already there. We've just added a couple more. Another provision that we've put into this bill is that right now ORS 568 allows for a district to go from 7 to 5 director positions, but it does not allow a district to go from 5 to 7. Districts such as East Multnomah that have a new permanent rate limit and a much greater funding level than they had before have requested, for example, that maybe they would like to have a little broader representation and be able to ask people to join the board who represent maybe some of the urban areas and so forth that might not have had served before. Greater representation, and we thought it was a good idea, only going from up to 7. And there's a few other clarifications about authorities of the department to assist us to get through business when there's a lack of a quorum and a district cannot take action, like appointing another person or something like that. We've had instances where we've had that difficulty and somebody else had to step in. In the past, it's been the county. We feel that the Department of Agriculture is in a better position to know whom and how to fill the position to make the balance on the board serve well. Now, this issue about the write-ins is there's obviously the clearest way is file a nomination petition and get on the ballot. That's what we always desire to do. That's what we recruit people to do and try to get that done. In the event that there is no candidate on the ballot, that opens up all kinds of things about write-ins. And we have to honor the great creativity and ingenuity of some of the individuals who've chosen to put themselves on the ballot, either their name, an assumed name, or all kinds of names, some of which are not for public record. They're in public record, but we don't broadcast them. So we've set up a process called a declaration of intent and request for write-in votes to be taken. We ask that a person who wishes to be a director file this, with the Department of Agriculture 14 days before the Elections Day. And that would be, that would give us two opportunities. One is we find out that the person really is serious, and secondly, it gives us time to find out if the person is eligible. Do they qualify? Because there are certain restrictions. A lot of the people who write their name in with good intentions find out later that, you know, they weren't even eligible for that zone position because they didn't live in that zone. We're trying to make
here's the fellow who won was written in, but he was already signed up for another zone.
Another zone, yes.
In East Lane. Yeah. So the position became vacant, and 15 paid election workers took 2 days to count ballots.
And that's not the worst one in the state. We've had people talk about, you know, just 40 hours of work, you know, and extra pay and mm-hmm. long spreadsheets and nobody was qualified and stuff like that. So we've tried to give ease a situation where if there is a declaration of intent that is considered a valid candidate, then those, the write-in votes for that individual would be counted. If there is no candidate on the ballot filed through the normal process, and there is no letter of intent from anybody for write-ins, and what we get is just a smattering of writings, this bill would say that the county officer, county clerk, may not count any of the write-ins for that position. So.
I'm kind of not liking that one. I mean, I understand you're trying to simplify it, but for instance, my son was looking at his ballot and saw there was nobody signed up. So he started thinking about, wow, that'd be cool. He has a degree in geography, and he thought, I might want to run for this seat. I think this would be a good thing. So he goes out and recruits all these people to put his name on the ballot. Apparently he didn't get more than 35 because that's who had the most number of votes. And here's someone who's just sitting in his living room thinking about his ballot and thinking, you know, that might be kind of cool. So I kind of like leaving it open for people to do this. So I just have a little bit of angst about that. But I'll hear from the rest of you before we get started pontificating. Mm-hmm. Sir, you're next.
Yeah, you are.
Sure, I can come. Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I will address really briefly, because I think John did a very good job of pretty much touching on everything of the bill. The county clerks are in total support of this bill. We have two real advantages here. One of the problems has been whether the department is supposed to act as the filing officer and do all of the communicating with the districts, advertising for the positions for election and so forth, or if the clerks are going to do it. And most of us clerks felt that the statute was clear that the department would do it. But the Secretary of State was saying, no, it wasn't real clear. So this is going to settle that matter, right? And so that the department will be, and the clerks won't have to do redundantly the same work. Also, the second thing, of course, is the fact that if no one files for the position, and most soil and water districts in the state are pretty much countywide, so if we have a position that's not filed for, you're looking at a countywide count of write-in, okay? If no one files under the normal manner, these people who might be interested have up until 14 days before the election to file this intent that they'd like to have their votes counted as write-ins. And basically that provides that the ballots will be out at that time. So people have had notice before, and they will have notice by the ballot being in hand that there is a write-in possibility here. So they have time to file timely before the election that they really would like to be a candidate, and they want to have their write-in ballots counted.
But Ms. Coleman, how would they know? How will you get that information out to the person who's
if you have a ballot that has no candidate filed in your hand?
Mm-hmm. Well, how would you know what the process is?
Well, how would the voter know? Is that what you're getting at?
No, how would the potential candidate know?
They would have to contact a district or the county clerk's office.
Okay. Maybe.
As most people have to do to find out any information about that.
Right. Uh-huh. So, I mean, our legislative assistant, committee assistant, just pointed out to me that my son would not have qualified because he doesn't manage 10 acres of land.
Right.
Which is one of the other things that's required. Not only do you have to live in the district, you have to manage 10 acres of land.
Correct.
For the zone positions, there are at-large positions, two at-large positions, yeah, where that isn't a qualification.
Yeah. I think part of the problem is when people see this on the ballot as an open thing, they don't know what the qualifications are. Just, well, I'd like to do that. Mm-hmm. I wish there could be more information provided in the voter's instruction in your ballot, but
unfortunately, there's qualifications for almost every office, so, you know, some of that is not something that's put on the ballot.
Well, I realize that, but you're trying to do something completely different with these positions, more so than any other position, write-in position, mm-hmm, on the ballot. Any other position, you can write your name in, and if you get enough votes, you win.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to do something different here. Am I not getting that correctly? You're shaking your head.
Madam Chair, but there is a difference in qualification here.
Right.
To run for the Oregon Senate, all you have to do is be a resident of the Senate district. It's the only I'm of legal age and a few other things.
Sound mine?
No, that's obviously not a requirement. So, but you know, I mean, I think the issue here is because there are qualifications one has to meet to qualify, the issue is requiring the county clerks to count write-ins, which is very time-consuming, for people who aren't qualified, and which is a moot point and kind of an expense that that fruit doesn't bear, or that tree doesn't bear any fruit. So,
well, I get that, Senator Cruz, but my point is, if we're going to sort of change the way it's done here for this particular one, you know, you get an instruction sheet in your ballot. It comes from the county. Why can't there be some instruction in that sheet that tells you if there's a vacant position, please be advised you must meet the requirements and go to this location to find out, or call us to find out what the requirements are before you put your name on there. I mean, can't you do that? You're scrunching your eyebrows. Identify yourself and talk to us, please.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, I'm Paul Reed. I'm a director with East Lane Soil and Water Conservation District and also a member of the Executive Board of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. I might comment that there are other special districts. I just name a few, the education related districts, school boards, education service districts, etc., that have very specific geographic qualifications for the position. You can't run for a zone position if you don't live in that zone.
Right.
Now, there's a different process in place. You generally, if you think you want to file for a school board position, you go to the county election office and you tell them where you live, and they look it up on the map and say, yes, you do or you don't live in that position. In the case of conservation districts, the county election clerks have not wanted to get involved in that because it encompasses the land ownership requirements and the whole management concept, et cetera. They've left that up to the Department of Agriculture to make that determination. Now, there is a legal notice that's published in the newspaper of record in the area that indicates that there are certain positions that are going to be on the ballot in the coming election, and those are listed by either zone or at-large positions. If a person seeks a position such as that you would think that they would take the time to find out what the qualifications for that position are. Now, in the case of your son, if he had been of such a mind in 2002, we might have him on our board right now. Because in 2002, we had an at-large position as well as his own position that was on the ballot. And he could have qualified for the at-large position because all he had to do was live in the district and be a registered voter. But the zone positions have specific land ownership or management responsibilities, and the basis of that is that primarily we're an agricultural related service industry that or service body that works a lot with production agriculture. Now, since the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds came into place and the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act and all of those, we tend now to be involved with almost anybody who's engaged in any kind of agricultural activity, including the little five-acre hobby farm that has two or three horses that run out in the pasture. So our scope of activity has expanded, but it's still related to agricultural practices. Now, I provided you a copy of the Tri-County News, an excerpt from the Tri-County News, which is a semi-weekly publication that is in North Lane County and Linn County and Benton County. And it talks about the 2004 vote, and that's kind of an example. And I might go back even previously to the 2002 one and give you a little anecdote of what happened there. A person got the ballot in the mail in their, 15 days in advance, and saw that nobody had filed for a couple of positions. There was one at-large position, one zone position. And so he turned out to be a stage magician and was at a nightclub act. And on the Saturday before the election, he said, well, you know, this would be kind of neat. He thought we got paid. I wish we did, but we don't. He thought it would be a good way to supplement his income. He thought it would be neat to have a position in government. So he encouraged all of his people to write him in, all the people that were in the audience at that time. Well, it turned out that he got the most votes, times two. They wrote him in on each of two positions. Well, he wasn't qualified for either of positions because he turned out to be not a resident of the zone, and he turned out to not have any land management responsibility, so he wasn't qualified.
And all of his magic tricks weren't going to get him there.
So, you know, that's just a couple of anecdotal reasons why. Now, you know, I think Senator Cruz probably has a better appreciation than some do about the degree of difficulty in getting people to sign up or to agree to run. And so, as you noted in this newspaper article that I sent, there were 21 conservation districts out of 45 in the state who had at least one position that wasn't filled at the time. Now, there's been a greater effort made to work harder to secure people to run for positions, but it's a time-consuming task. There's a lot of responsibility, and there's no money in it. Now, the ones that are in the best position now to get multiple people to file are the ones that have tax bases. There are 10 of those now, and like Marion County had contested races. Now, you know, we could only imagine in the districts that don't have tax bases of having contested elections. We're happy enough we can get one person to put their name on there. But the reality is that there is nothing that stops anybody from writing their name in. So we're not denying anybody their constitutional right to write their name in. If that suits their intent and they believe that it's interesting to do that, then go ahead. What we're doing with this legislation is just to say that if you're not qualified, the county clerks don't have to spend hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars of staff time counting write-in ballots. If you are qualified and you want to run occasionally, like for instance in 2004 in Linn County, Linn Soil and Water Conservation District, one of the district directors had given his nominating position to his son to get sent off and sent to the Department of Agriculture after he had the signatures validated. Well, the son put it in the desk drawer and forgot to send it off. So he wanted to run as a write-in candidate. So he mounted a write-in campaign, and since he was well-known in the area, he ended up getting reelected. But this is typical of the kind of a person who could then file one of these declarations of intent and have their name, their write-in votes counted if they appeared on the ballot.
My question is, and maybe Ms. Coleman can answer this, how would county elections officers know the person isn't qualified unless you first assess that? I mean, you have to look at all the ballots and you have to decide whether any of those people qualify. So you have to look them up anyway, do you not?
No. Under current law, what we do is if there is no candidate filed, the law says we have to count the write-ins for that position. Doesn't matter. At that point, we're counting the write-ins for the position. At the end of the election, we would send the results to the district, who then decides if that person who got the most votes is qualified to hold the position.
Oh, so you don't make that decision?
No.
The district does?
Department would do that.
Okay. Well, that's a confusing little bill. Do you have any comments, sir?
Sure. Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Larry Oyu. I'm the program manager at the Oregon Department of Agriculture for the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And John and Jan and Paul have all spoke to the number of different issues. I do want to state I think there are some very good things in this bill, some housekeeping bills about vacancies. Chair Walker, your question about how would somebody know, I think it's a very good question. We've actually had some conversation about that. One thing that the department can do would be to provide information. We provide information on our website about the filing dates, the petition forms, you can actually download the form. So we could have some information on the website. Somebody would still need to go there to look for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the reason for this is if historically we had vacancies and the write-in candidates had qualified and there wasn't all this work and costs for nothing, that wouldn't be the issue. But the history has shown that in many, many cases, the writing candidate didn't qualify or they're fictitious character. So this is simply our collective thoughts about how to provide some relief to the county clerk's office to not incur lots of costs to count those write-in ballots. The other thing that we've made a commitment to do for the last 4 years is try to get the conservation districts to do more outreach, to let them know our intent, our goal is to not have any vacancies on the ballot. And as Paul mentioned, we're seeing more and more districts, especially with the districts with tax rates, have contested races. In Jan's County, there was one position that had four people running for the district position on one position. So we support the bill. We support providing some relief for the county clerks because they've been good partners with us. We would make the commitment to provide whatever additional outreach and information that we could do to help address the concerns that you raised. So,
okay.
Senator Walker?
Yes.
I'm not only president of the Oregon Association, I'm also the chairman of the Tualatin Soil Water Conservation District in Washington County.
And you filed to be on the ballot, right?
Reluctantly, yes. Yeah. It's like slipping judgment 12 years ago, and I haven't been able to get off this. So anyway, I, as speaking for what our district would do, if we had no candidate files,
mm-hmm.
the information that goes out to the voters' pamphlet, the information that we provide to the newspapers, the information that we provide for anybody who calls the office, and any other way we can get it, would put out the fact that here is the process that is necessary if you wish to have your name on that position. And I think we can, through both what the department can do and the normal channels and so forth, we can go out of our way to make sure that this is publicly known. It is advertised as the process to get in, because we know well in advance, it's not 14 days before that we know who's going to be on the ballot. Mm-hmm. You know, we know we can, there's a certain filing deadline that's well ahead of that. So we know, whoops, there's a vacancy.
Right.
So we take upon ourselves the initiative and the department and so forth of advertising in that area, you know, that there's a vacancy. And there is a procedure to get your name into a write-in.
Well, I was thinking, why don't we just turn these all into appointed positions? But then one of you mentioned that there were contested races in Marion County, so I thought, no, we're not doing that, Senator Westland.
Madam Chair, maybe I echo your, I don't know what the right word is here, but maybe I echo your, you know, I don't want to say frustration, but concern. I'm just confused. I mean, I understand the problem you're trying to solve. It's a legitimate problem. But the way the world works, I mean, isn't it, you know, a better, simpler, less costly solution if you have a given soil and water district anywhere in the state and you've got zone 2 open and the district knows that, as you were indicating, and you know, you like candidate A for zone 2 in a write-in and you like candidate B, for you guys to get out there, you know, and say, hey, this position is open. Larry, I think you'd be a great commissioner. Sam, I think you'd be a great commissioner. And informally make sure those positions are filled, even in competitive races, you know, albeit no-file candidate, just to get that job done, you know, without requiring legislation. I guess I'm trying to find, you know, the value in this. I understand the clerk's position. Here you are counting all these write-ins. Well, I don't mean this negatively. That's your job. I mean, that's what you do anyway. I mean, if, you know, for a Senate race or a gubernatorial race or a city council race, you're counting a ton of write-ins.
No.
No.
You're not?
If I may.
Mm-hmm. Well, for the state races.
No. Chair Walker, Senator Westland, no, we don't. The law only says we count write-ins if the write-ins appear to be larger than the winning person. So we do not count those write-ins.
Okay, you're correct. I misspoke. I mean, if you have a school board position that's vacant or a water council.
If any position, there's no candidate
right.
filed, yes, we have to count
exactly.
the write-ins. But in a school board situation, in a district situation, so forth, the costs of us doing that go toward the cost of the election, okay? Soil and water, it goes towards the cost of the election, but the county picks it up. So, in essence, and I gave you some figures there, in 2004, Multnomah County spent over $20,000 extracting write-ins for soil and water. And it was for two districts, three positions. Nobody qualified. So counties are spending a whole lot of money on this process, and too many times, no one even qualifies.
If you get your amendment, though, and Senator Westland has a further question than Senator Morris, if you get the amendment you wanted, though, you won't count any write-in unless someone asks you to.
That's correct.
But if it's a vacant...
Even if it's a vacant
seat. I mean, a non-filed position, they're going to come, understandably, the Soil and Water Conservation District is going to come to you and say, did somebody win? I mean, give us the information so we can determine. They're going to do that anyway.
But the amendment says the clerks will not count the ballots unless you ask them to, if you're a write-in. So the Soil and Water Conservation District can come and say, did we have a winner? And they would say, well, no, we have lots of write-ins, but no one asked us to count them, so we didn't count them. I mean, that's what's hard for me.
I just can't imagine that that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Senator Morris.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I for one, happen to believe that this is a pretty good amendment. And I think the operative word here is intentional. Because if you have write-in candidates that are not intentional, they're passive, it's a joke, it's humor, it really demeans the whole process of an election. And if someone does not have the interest to file a declaration to be declared eligible to be, to serve in that position, then I think we've really kind of lost sight of the purpose of an election. And absent that, then the department has the ability to make a determination as to who would fill that position on an intentional basis. So I happen to believe that this is a pretty reasonable amendment, and I don't think it lessens people's access. It just needs to be intentional, in my judgment.
Madam Chair, if I could, I'm following on Senator Morrison. And getting back to the example of your son, who thought maybe this would be interesting if he was serious about it.
He was.
Well, but not enough. Okay, my question is, I mean, to serve on a board is a commitment. I mean, it's a commitment, and you have to be serious about it. And I guess I just can't imagine a reasonable person who sees a vacant position and thinks, I want to fill that, not asking somebody a question at some point in time, which is all they'd have to do. And then they find out. I mean, there are several places they could go. If it was me and I was serious about something like that, the first place I would go would be the county clerk who runs the elections and say, I'm doing a write-in. What do I need to do? And you would give me the answer. And so,
or direct you to the
council.
Right. Right. I mean, she'd give me the answer what I need to do. And the answer would need to me to make the contact and say, I have a write-in. Check me out, basically, at that point in time. The fact is, back to Senator Westland, yeah, it would be nice if all positions were vied for, but they're not. I would say one thing about soil district boards of directors, they do tend to mostly be farmers who are really independent critters. It's not really an understatement. But it is a huge commitment, and sometimes it's hard to get somebody willing to step up to the plate. And, that's just the nature of the beast. I agree with Senator Morse. I think this is a reasonable approach, but I also believe we're going to need to see a -3 amendment.
Well, we actually have a -3.
Well, not in LC
that's
form.
That's just our construction.
It's not in LC
yeah.
form.
Yeah, so anyway, we're running out of time. We have to do a work session. Since you served on a soil and water conservation district, would you be interested in working with these folks on trying to come up with something?
I'd be more than happy to, and the other point I'd make on this is because Representative Dingfelder was also involved with soil and water for a long time, and I just think this might be a very rare opportunity where I could support one of her bills.
Okay. All right, well, Mr. McDonald, did you have one more comment?
Yes, Senator Walker, I'm just saying that we didn't seem to be presumptuous by the two additional handouts that we had. One is we took the -2 language that was provided by LC. If we did it what we really wanted to do, it would look like what we provided to you, which was 3. Because the author did some good things, one of which we liked, which was to insert that thing about that it would go through the department to find out about qualification, eligibility, and so forth. That was great. It was a good addition.
Mm-hmm.
But then in leaving out a few other things, left out some of the major provisions that we were seeking. And then the second handout is, if you applied -3, the second handout said this is how Section 530 would read, and just some bolded things as showing where the change would make and so forth. That's what we'd like to have actually come out in the text.
Okay. We will leave you all in the good hands of Senator Cruz to try to figure this one out. The House put it in our hands. And it's been a fascinating discussion. I'll have to tell my son he is now back home again. eligible to be in the district for an at-large position, so I'll tell him to get right on it.
Senator Walker, if you give us your name, we'll be out recruiting.
Yeah.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. Well, I told him running for office wasn't an easy thing, and you've certainly proved that. All right. Thank you all. I appreciate you coming today. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3466. And, colleagues, we have one more issue, a work session. I will open on House Bill 2729A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2729A authorizes the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to establish the Aspire program. It establishes an Aspire program fund within the general fund. It continuously appropriates monies in the fund to the commission for the program, declares an emergency, and would take effect July 1st, 2007.
And then, if I remember correctly, we didn't go into work session because we hadn't posted it.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yes. And
this is the bill in which we were inspired, then starting to perspire because of all the testimony on Aspire, but we couldn't move the bill. So let's just move the bill.
Okay. Madam Chair. Well, thank you for that, Senator Metzger. It clarified everything for me. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2729A to the Senate floor with a D-pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2729A to the Senate floor with a D-pass recommendation. Discussion, Senator Morse? You're kidding.
No. I just want to clarify the removal of subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The government's budget has $1.4 million. All this bill does is set in policy. It makes no appropriation.
Right. That's exactly correct.
Thank you.
So, and
we hope we get the appropriation.
Yeah, that would be nice. Okay, any further discussion? Then, Ms. Gravel, you are on.
Senator
Metzger. Aye.
Senator Moore.
Aye.
Senator Leslie.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz. Aye.
Chair Walker.
Aye. House Bill 2729A is approved and will go to the Senate. Senator Metzger, you or me?
I'm happy to, sure.
Okay, there you go. You can talk about aspiring and perspiring. Okay, colleagues, we did it. 2 minutes under. We haven't done that in a while. Remember, now you have Thursday free, so we will meet again at the committee next Tuesday, and I'm sure we will have lots to work with. So thank you very much. We're adjourned.